Okay, so now that the slides are up, first we will hear from the scientists at the Dartmouth College Toxic Metals SRP Center. Despite growing concern and increasing research on arsenic and mercury, there are a number of significant knowledge gaps, especially with regards to the very low levels of exposure found here in the U.S. The Dartmouth College Toxic Metals SRP Center conducts multidisciplinary research to identify major sources of arsenic and mercury exposure and to better understand how early life exposure to these contaminants affect health. We will hear from Dartmouth SRP Center Director, Dr. Bruce Stanton, project leader and leader of the Dartmouth SRP Center Research Translation Corps, Dr. Celia Chen, and project leader, Dr. Mary Lou Grenot. So I'll turn it over to Dr. Stanton.
Okay, thanks, Danielle. Can you hear me okay?
I can hear you just fine.
Great. Thanks so much. Welcome, everybody. I appreciate the opportunity to tell everybody and talk a little bit about our center. What I'll do is give a brief overview of the entire program, the Superfund research program at Dartmouth, and then Dr. Grenot and Dr. Chen will give you specifics about our projects and our cores. So as Danielle just mentioned, our Superfund research program uses a very interdisciplinary approach to investigate the ways in which arsenic and mercury in the environment affect ecosystems and human health. And our research is highly relevant to the mission of the SRP because arsenic and mercury are two of the top three environmental chemicals of concern regarding human health in the U.S., arsenic being number one and mercury being number three. So we work with our stakeholders to first reduce exposure to arsenic in well water, rice, and rice products, and second, reduce exposure to mercury primarily by suggesting and recommending that folks eat low mercury fish and to reduce the coal burning emissions of mercury. So I'll next take a few seconds to walk through some of our projects. Project number one is led by Mary Lou Grenot, and Mary Lou is the project leader, and she works with several individuals, including David Salt at Aberdeen. She has a really nice review with some of her colleagues that's indicated in this slide, Nature Journal, and the link down there is at the bottom of the slide. The second project is by Celia Chen, and that's methylmercury production and fate in response to multiple environmental factors. Celia is the project leader, and she collaborates with Rob Mason at the University of Connecticut and Nick Fisher at Stony Brook. And again, we list a paper that she published recently, Environmental and Natural Warming Elevates Mercury Concentrations in Estuarine Fish. And again, the link is down on the lower right. Third project is my project, Arsenic in the Innate Immune Function of the Lung. I work with a really clever bioinformatician, Tom Hampton. And a recent paper that we published as part of our research translation work, and it's a very nice review on arsenic in the environment and in the effects that arsenic has on human health. And that was recently published about a month ago in Current Environmental Health Reports, and that is available on PubMed. Our last project is by Margaret Karagas, and that's on arsenic epidemiology, biomarkers, and exposure assessment of metals. And again, there's a link to a recent paper from her group. And Margaret has a biomedical project to elucidate how exposure to arsenic contributes to respiratory infections and inflammation in adults, and how arsenic contributes to the development of metabolic syndromes in mothers and newborns. Now I'll switch over to our cores. We have several cores. One is a trace element analysis core led very capably by Brian Jackson. Brian does an incredible job developing new techniques to identify and speciate mercury and arsenic, among other metals. We have a training core, of which I'm the director. We've done a number of activities with our trainees, including the Alan Alda Communication Workshops, which is based out of Stony Brook, SUNY at Stony Brook, which I would highly recommend to anybody interested in helping their students with communication. We've done science writers workshops, and recently we did a Northeast Regional SRP workshop where people in the region, in the New England region, you know, six different Superfund programs got together with our trainees to run trainee-related events. We also have, like all Superfund programs, we have a research translation corps led by Lori Reardon in collaboration with Celia Chen. We do stakeholder outreach on arsenic, mercury, and Superfund sites to a number of agencies, including the DES, CDC, ATSDR, EPA, and 27 others that I won't list. We have a community engagement corps run by Catherine Lawler and Mark Borsick. They took the initiative and are working with the New Hampshire Department of Environmental Sciences. They have a grant that, and they're working with private well outreach in six New Hampshire communities. We recently collaborated with folks at the MDI Biolab in up in Bar Harbor, Maine, and with Jane Disney, and we have an EPA environmental educational grant led by Jane, and the purpose of that is to engage school children and teachers to monitor private wells for arsenic. We were asked to present solutions to the problem of arsenic and mercury in the environment, and so through our research, training, translation, and community engagement corps, we will provide relevant information to empower our stakeholders and the communities with whom we engage to make informed decisions to reduce their exposure to arsenic and mercury and thereby provide improve public health. So I think, Danielle, that was the end of mine, and then I wanted to turn that over to Mary Lou and then Celia.
Yes, please do that.
Go ahead.
Good afternoon. Can everyone hear me?
Yes.
This is Mary Lou Guerno, and I would like to talk briefly about some of the projects that Bruce just introduced. So I'll start with my own project, which is Project One, and we're studying arsenic uptake, transport, and storage in plants. And in particular, we're interested in arsenic in rice, because rice, of course, is a staple food that's eaten by half the world every day. In addition, there are many rice-based foods that are on the market, most notably including infant rice cereals and infant formula. And then another factor that leads to people eating a lot of rice-based products is, of course, people have allergies to gluten, and therefore they turn to rice. Now, where's all this arsenic coming from that ends up in rice? Well, arsenic, of course, occurs naturally in soil and groundwater. And in addition, it was used for many years in pesticides that were applied to rice fields. There are several factors that actually contribute to rice being a really efficient accumulator of arsenic relative to other cereals. So the first, of course, is that a lot of rice is cultivated in flooded paddies. And there are two forms of arsenic out in the environment. There's the reduced form arsenite, and then there's the more oxidized form arsenate. So in the paddy, you're going to have mobilization of arsenite. Why is that bad? Well, it turns out that rice can't distinguish between arsenite and silicic acid. And rice takes up silicon because it's very beneficial for the rice plant. It strengthens its stems, and it provides really good protection against pathogens. So they're inadvertently taking up the arsenite when they think they're taking up silicic acid. In addition, in a more aerobic environment, like when you grow upland rice, then they have a problem distinguishing arsenate from phosphate. So again, it's an inadvertent uptake of arsenate when they think they're getting phosphate. And rice can accumulate 10 times as much silicon, for example, as other grasses, and that means they're going to accumulate 10 times as much arsenic. So moving on then, there are currently no statutory limits for the arsenic content of food that's sold in the U.S. or Europe, although last year the FAO, WHO, did issue a recommendation that the level of arsenic in rice should not exceed 0.2 milligrams per kilogram. So So to just try and give you a little idea about how much risk there might be in consuming rice, average U.S. consumption is a half a cup a day, and the Project 4 group in 2011 made the comparison to say that if you eat a half a cup of rice a day, it's about like drinking a liter per day of water that has the maximum contaminant limit for arsenic that was set at 10 micrograms arsenic per liter. So there's been a lot of press about arsenic in rice. Some of you may have seen this. This is just an example. The January 2015 issue of Consumer Reports made up rice rules where, depending on which form of rice you're eating and how much, you're only supposed to accumulate 7 points a week. So I'll refer you to that. And then as far as solutions go, our project has really been devoted to trying to understand how rice takes up arsenic and how it ends up in the grain. We've screened almost 2,000 cultivars of rice looking for those that accumulate less arsenic, because that would really be the simplest, fastest, and most cost-effective approach to really solving the problem of arsenic contamination of rice. If we find low accumulating cultivars, they could go immediately into these arsenic-rich soils, and of course they could be used as stock for breeding programs so that we'd end up with this low-grain arsenic trait in our improved varieties that we use now for commercial production. So turning to Project 3, which is the project led by Bruce Statton, this project, as Bruce briefly mentioned, looks at the effect of arsenic on respiratory disease, because respiratory infections are the third most frequent cause of death worldwide. And it's already been shown that ingestion of arsenic increases the incidence of these respiratory infections by bacteria and fungi. In addition, in utero arsenic exposure has been shown to increase respiratory infections and actually dysregulate the fetal immune system. And this was work out of the Karagas group, which is part of our Superfund program. So basically what's supposed to happen when you get a bacterial infection, cells will secrete signaling compounds called interleukins or cytokines, and these help recruit the cells of your immune system, macrophages and neutrophils, to come to the lungs and then engulf and kill the invaders. If you have excessive or inadequate release of these signaling molecules, you can get inappropriate clearance of these bacteria, in addition, chronic and irreversible lung damage and death. So studies in the Statton lab have already shown that low levels of arsenic, typical of our U.S. exposure levels, definitely can disrupt these interleukin secretion and the ability of the macrophages to kill bacteria in the lung. So as they work through understanding the molecular mechanisms of what's going on and how does arsenic actually interfere, this group is working to educate state legislatures, journalists, and public advocacy groups to help increase awareness of the arsenic problem. Project 3 has also worked with New Hampshire and Maine state legislatures to pass bills to inform new homeowners that a possibility that they might have arsenic in their well water, and also work with the FDA to help establish regulations for arsenic in food as well as well waters. The third project that I'd just like to introduce is Project 4, and this is led by Margaret Karagas, and that's on the epidemiology, biomarkers, and exposure assessment of metals. Margaret's group has worked on both mercury and arsenic. And her project in particular now is addressing cardiovascular disease, which is the number one cause of morbidity and mortality worldwide. And what she wants to do is investigate whether higher arsenic exposure can actually influence these cardiovascular disease risk factors in a unique group of pregnant women, and then look at things like glucose metabolism, blood pressure, markers of inflammation, and other signs of dysfunction. In addition to looking at the pregnant women, the project also is going to ask about in utero exposure and how that affects cardiometabolic factors in the newborn. The study is being carried out with the New Hampshire birth cohort, which was established in 2009. And it, as I said, it asks if pregnancy is a susceptibility window for arsenic exposure. Over 40%, about 40% of people in New Hampshire are on private wells, and 10% or more of those wells are known to have arsenic. So private well users is the study group. Over 1,200 mother-infant pairs have been contacted, and a very high response rate to participate in the study, over about 75%. And of those people participating in the study, they have been able to collect urinary arsenic samples from almost 100% of the participants. So just to finish, I'll just give you one example of the type of data that's coming out of Margaret and her group's efforts. They've just published a paper showing that arsenic is indeed related to increases in blood pressure over the course of pregnancy. So if we look at this graph here on the slide, you can see on the x-axis there is maternal urinary arsenic, and then on the y-axis blood pressure. And as the arsenic level increases in the urine, you see an increase in blood pressure, and the reference to the paper is there. So then just to finish up, the work from Project 4 is working, they're determining the effects of low levels of arsenic exposure during pregnancy, and then they're working to communicate this information in a number of ways through publications, media releases, participation in lay publications such as Consumer Reports, different panels that Margaret and her group have served on. And then Margaret and I are co-leading a CIFAR initiative, which I think you will hear about later on in the presentation. So I can turn it over to Celia.
Great. Thank you, Mary Lou. I'm going to advance the slide here. I'm the project leader for Project 2, which focuses on methylmercury production and fate in response to multiple environmental factors. In particular, we're interested in those factors associated with climate change. So our lab studies the fate of methylmercury in estuaries, which are major sources of fisheries production in coastal waters. And as many of you know, methylmercury is a neurotoxin of concern, which has impacts on the health of particularly children, indigenous populations who eat a lot of marine mammals, and other populations through consumption of seafood. The fate of methylmercury in these marine ecosystems will be affected by many environmental factors that are changing with changes in our climate. And the most direct change will be increased atmospheric and ocean temperatures, which have the potential to increase methylation rates. And I'm going to use the pointer here, I think. Sorry. No. It doesn't appear to be working. Increased methylation rates and uptake of mercury and methylmercury by biota. Increases in rainfall and runoff and stream flow, which are predicted particularly for areas in the northeast U.S., will increase loading of nutrients and also mercury from the watersheds, and also increase productivity and potentially biomass dilution of mercury, which we know has a tendency to decrease mercury in fish. It will also potentially increase carbon flux to sediments and the water column, which will impact mercury methylation, and also potentially decrease salinity downstream, which we are now trying to understand how salinity actually affects methylmercury production and bioaccumulation. With predicted sea level rise, we also will have the opposite effect of increased salinity upstream, and also increased submergence of soils and potentially increased mercury methylation from the release of methylmercury from methylation that occurs in submerged sediments. For those of you who aren't familiar with mercury, I'm just going to go through this diagram. In the top right, we see that the sources of mercury are largely atmospheric, from mostly artisanal scale gold mining and coal-fired power plants, as well as industrial point sources that discharge directly into waterways. Once that mercury in its inorganic form is transported into coastal waters, I'll take you down to the yellow circle in the bottom, where the inorganic mercury is methylated in sediments to produce methyl mercury, the more toxic and bioavailable form. From there, it's bioaccumulated by phytoplankton and ingested by primary consumers, and with each level of the food chain, it's biomagnified. But the greatest increase is actually from the step from water to plankton. Ultimately, the methylmercury is transferred to fish that we consume and are caught in coastal waters. These processes of methylmercury production, bioaccumulation, and trophic transfer are influenced by environmental factors associated with climate change, which are shown up in the orange circle in the upper left. So our research goals in Project 2 are to examine individual and the combined effects of the three climate-induced factors, temperature, salinity, and organic carbon inputs, on both methylmercury production in estuarine sediments and flux from the sediments to the water column, and also then bioaccumulation by lower trophic levels of the estuarine food web, which then form the basis for the transfer that goes up to fish that we consume. In addition to our specific research questions, we're also working on a number of other solutions to the global problem of mercury pollution. And these solutions, we believe, are informed and supported by our mercury science. We've been active in discussions about current global and domestic policies to reduce emissions and discharges of mercury to the environment, including the International Minamata Treaty, as well as the U.S. Mercury Rule, which was just recently reviewed by the Supreme Court. We're also active partners in the UNEP Fate and Transport Partnerships, which are currently compiling data sets and developing strategies for evaluating the effectiveness of the Minamata Treaty once it's fully ratified, which they hope will be in the next year or two. And finally, we are really active at the local and regional levels in educating the public about the risks and benefits of consuming fish and participating in the national dialogue about fish consumption advisories. So next, I'm going to turn to the Trace Element Analysis Corps, which is led by Brian Jackson and also co-led by Tracy Punchin. And we really couldn't do the research that we do without our Trace Element Analysis Corps, which I'll call the TEA Corps. It provides trace metal analyses and allows our program to increase our understanding of the speciation and partitioning of arsenic and mercury in these vectors of human exposure, specifically water, food, and aquatic food webs. The TEA services, core services, include trace metal analysis, mercury speciation, arsenic speciation, and a whole variety of method development. In addition, our TEA postdoc trainee, Vivian Taylor, received a Casey Donnelly Fellowship last year to develop a mercury passive sampler, which we're now beginning to test in the field. Perhaps most important to our program has been the collaboration of the projects with the TEA Corps to help develop analytical methods that are really able to address specific questions of each project. For instance, the TEA Corps has developed really sensitive methods to determine mercury speciation in single invertebrate organisms, which has been very important to Project 2, and has also used elemental imaging techniques to develop spatial elemental images of arsenic in rice grains, which is shown there in the center panel. The Corps really strives to maintain state-of-the-art instrumentation, and they've recently acquired a new triple quad ICP-MS, which provides lower element detection limits across the periodic table, but is especially beneficial for arsenic analysis. And co-leader Tracy Punchin, her research program uses the synchrotron X-ray techniques for biological elemental imaging and speciation, And Tracy is working on through the TA Corps to provide this expertise and assist projects in using this technology. The TA Corps is also working with the Community Engagement Corps and the gluten-free community to quantify the amount and form of arsenic in gluten-free products. And lastly, the TA Corps also continues to support Project 4 and collaborates with the National Cancer Institute and the Spanish National Cancer Research Center. And you can see a publication from one of those collaborations in the bottom right corner. Next, I'll move on to the Research Translation Corps. I'm the PI for the Research Translation Corps, and I work very closely with Lori Reardon, who is our RTC coordinator. The aims of our RTC include assisting the US EPA at a number of Superfund sites that are listed in the slide. We also share innovative methods being developed in the TEA Corps with our colleagues and with our stakeholders. We also facilitate communication between scientists and policymakers on the sources and effects of arsenic exposure. We are collaborating with stakeholder organizations, ones that Bruce mentioned earlier, and as well as New England PACES on risk decisions related to arsenic in food and mercury in fish. We also provide opportunities for our research scientists and trainees to develop relationships with stakeholders and communicate their research. And we also are in the process of developing a centralized website on arsenic and mercury. Among our many current projects, we've been involved in increasing science communication abilities of our scientists. And Bruce mentioned this earlier. We have really collaborated quite a lot with the Alan Alda Center for Communicating Science and held workshops in which our trainees and other colleagues at other institutions and NGOs have participated. We recently hosted a research translation and community engagement session at the annual NAC-CTAC meeting. We've also been involved every year in running the New Hampshire Arsenic Consortium. And we are continuing always to work with our CEC to help with their arsenic and private well work in New Hampshire. And we are also very involved, as Mary Lou mentioned earlier, in a collaborative on food with arsenic and associated risk and risk regulation, in which we're trying to bring together an interdisciplinary group of scientists and policy stakeholders to synthesize the science and identify knowledge gaps. And these will ultimately be published in peer-reviewed synthesis papers in a special journal issue. This is modeled very much after a similar kind of effort we did with mercury called CMERC. And lastly, as I mentioned earlier, we're developing an arsenic and food and water website, and that will also form the basis for developing our mercury website later on. Next, I'll move to the Community Engagement Corps. Our core leader for that core is Mark Borsick, and our coordinator for the CEC is Catherine Lawler. And the aims of our CEC are to sustain engagement with community partners in Northern New England to help them better understand and support healthy decision making. They also are cultivating opportunities for Dartmouth to serve community partners by providing resources, information, and communication, as well as the expertise of our scientists. And also, the CEC fosters collaborative community-engaged research. The communities that the CEC is engaged with include parents and expectant parents, consumers of things like rice products and fish, as well as private well owners in New Hampshire who have potentially high levels of arsenic in their well water, and lastly, high school science students. In the arsenic and private well project, the CEC has been involved in a couple years now, in a second year of doing interventions with community members and trying to determine the reasons for which citizens of these communities that have high arsenic in their wells are not inclined to have their wells tested. And so at this point in time, they are involved in doing some education and intervention with some of these communities. This map that was shown earlier shows you some of the areas of New Hampshire where well water, private well water exceeds 10 parts per billion. The CEC is also involved in a Dragonfly Mercury project, which works very closely with my project too. And in this case, this involves four high schools in Vermont and New Hampshire and is facilitated by the our trainee, Kate Buckman, who works in my lab. And the students do research projects around mercury in dragonflies as a sentinel species. And ultimately, each year, it culminates in an annual student symposium held at Dartmouth. We've received a lot of press coverage on this program and this annual event. In addition to all of the work that the RTC and CEC do in these projects, they wouldn't be possible without the participation of our each of our projects, at the scientists and the trainees. So, for example, projects 1, 2, and 4 are leading and very involved in the CFAR, the Collaborative on Food with Arsenic and Associated Risk and Regulation. As I mentioned, project 2 is involved in the Dragonfly project. And as mentioned earlier, Project 3 is really involved with arsenic legislation in Maine and New Hampshire and also led the Arsenic Summit. So now I will turn it back to Bruce and to talk about the rest.
Thanks, Celia and Mary Lou. Those presentations were terrific. Thank you so much. So our stakeholders, we were asked to just end with our list of our stakeholders and collaborations. As you can see on the first bullet, our stakeholders is a pretty long list. I'll give everyone a break and not read it. But our collaborators, who I would like to mention specifically, their pictures left to right, Nick Fisher at Stony Brook, David Salt in Aberdeen, Rob Mason at University of Connecticut, Susan Korick at Harvard, and Yu Chen at NYU, all terrific collaborators making significant contributions to our program. And so finally, just a closing comment. The goal of our center is by working together with the National Institutes of Environmental Health Sciences, our collaborators and stakeholders, we look forward to continuing to provide cutting-edge research to inform policy decisions and community actions that will lead to reduced human exposure to mercury and arsenic and improve public health. And so for more information about our program, you can go to that website that's listed at the bottom right of the page. And Danielle, I think that's the end of our presentation.
Well, thank you so much, Bruce, Celia, and Mary Lou. That was excellent, and I think you definitely covered, I would think, what the audience is most interested in. First of all, I just want to compliment you on what great examples that you provided of investigator-initiated research translation, as well as the work that you all have been doing for various policy changes. So with that, we've got a couple of questions that have come in. I think I'll just, because of the order, I think I'll just start with the arsenic and then go to mercury. But the first question comes in, and probably Mary Lou can maybe best address this one, but it's from Sarah Benevic, and she asks, have any studies been done on the levels of arsenic in organic rice? And then she follows that with, would organic rice have lower arsenic content if it is grown in healthier soils that weren't treated with pesticides and fertilizers?
So I guess the answer to the question is, to the extent that it's been analyzed, organic rice is about the same as regular rice. And brown rice has higher levels because the arsenic tends to accumulate in the outer layers. Now, if you were able to grow either organic rice or regular rice in soil that didn't have any arsenic, then it definitely would take up less arsenic.
Okay, Thank you. So the next question that comes in, again, to Mary Lou, this is from David Alden, and he asks, what are average arsenic contents in the rice plant or other cereals? And then he says, how is this measured? And then he follows it, are there instances of soybean oil or molasses containing arsenic?
So you can find arsenic in other foods, although it hasn't been studied as widely because of the fact that rice can take up 10 times as much as other grasses. It's measured by ICP-MS, so that is Brian Jackson, our trace element core type of approach, and that's very common. So it's digested, the material's digested and then analyzed. And I forgot what the third one was. Oh, levels. So levels can vary, but certainly when we were screening almost 2,000 rice varieties, many, many of those had levels higher than that recommended by the FAO. So, and that was unpolished rice. When you polish it, you go from brown to white, then the amounts drop, so white rice has much less. And I, you know, off the top of my head, I can't give you values, but those are available, and you can see some of those in the consumer reports, for example.
Okay. And then the other follow-up question that was about, could you find it, can you find it in soybean oil or molasses?
I don't know about those specifically. I think if Brian's on, he might be able to answer. Brian? Is Brian there, Jackson? Okay, sorry.
I guess if he's able to talk, he'd have to press pound six to unmute himself. Well, we can certainly follow up on
yeah,
that.
Yeah, if you send me an email, we can get back to you.
Okay, okay. So the next one actually goes to Celia. So Julius Nwosu asks, could you explain further how salinity affects methyl mercury?
Well, there isn't all that much known about how salinity affects it, but it is most likely that it affects it through the chloride ion, because the speciation of methyl mercury and what it's bound to really also influences the amount that gets bioaccumulated, and that's an area of active research at this point in time. But the chloride form of the methyl, the chloride form of methyl mercury is very bioavailable. And so, but we've seen some data to show that, so methyl mercury increasing in phytoplankton cells, uptake in phytoplankton cells with increasing chloride or increasing salinity. But we're seeing also that there appears to be a decrease in small invertebrates in their uptake of methyl mercury in increase in salinity. So it may be that at different levels of the food chain or food web that it differs. So those are questions that we are pursuing right now.
Okay, and I think that this is a good follow-up question for Celia. This comes from William Harris. He says he'd like to hear more about the mercury passive sampler for water.
Ah, yes. Well, Vivian Taylor is working on that, and she has been working in collaboration with her Casey Donnelly Fellowship in collaboration with Rob Burgess, who is down at the Narragansett lab of EPA. And I should say that they've just been working on it this past year, and if I would refer questions to her, I can certainly put you in touch with her. She is, they've been developing it, and we're actually going to test it in some of our field sites. So I think that's about as much as I can say about it, and I know that she would be able to tell you more.
Okay. We look forward to, and you know, and certainly as you mentioned about how she had one at Casey Donnelly, and you can always go to our website, the Superfund Research Program, and we have highlights of all of our Casey Donnelly Award winners, and you can look up Vivian's work on there as well. So, okay, so I guess we'll jump back to arsenic. So this is, I guess, for somebody mentions here, it's either for Celia or or Bruce, but this is from Fu Shin Li, and it says, what are the detection limits and quantitation limits for arsenic and mercury speciation? And then there's another part, but I'll let you answer that first.
That is a good Brian question, and I just know that with the new instrumentation that he has just acquired, it has dropped by at least an order or two orders of magnitude in their ability to speciate. So I am afraid that we might have to get the best information and refer you to Brian, and I do believe that Brian could only stay on for part of this call, so that's why he wasn't jumping in.
Okay. Cecilia? All right, Danielle, Brian is online, and he tried to answer the previous question. He hit #6, and he emailed me and said it doesn't seem to work. I don't know if we have suggestions.
Okay. Maybe this is something our webinar, our Jean or Sarah could help us with.
This is Jean. Know that if he can send in his telephone number into the Q&A window, I can try to manually unmute him.
Okay, I think he's still listening. He did send me an email just now. He said the question about soybean oil or molasses, he says he doesn't know anything about it, but he will look it up, and if there is any information, he will send it to the person who asked the question.
Okay, thanks, and thanks to Brian for doing that. So, and I assume that the next question is probably also meant for Brian, but, you know, I'll ask it anyway just because it came in. This is the second part of Fu Shin Li's question, but are the arsenic and mercury speciation methods used in this study the same as the ones used for Superfund sites?
Again, I think that's a question, like you said, Danielle, I think that's a question that would best be answered by Brian. Maybe we could move on, and if Brian can get on, he can answer those questions. If not, he can post the answers or provide the answers electronically at some point. Sorry about that.
I can certainly speak to the mercury. I mean, we work in Superfund sites in our project too, as well as our other pristine sites, and the methodologies are the same. It's certainly just a lot more difficult to get numbers in very small biomasses in pristine sites, and the TEA Corps has really developed some wonderful techniques for doing that and really has allowed us to do the kind of work we do. So, but those techniques are the same as are used in the Superfund sites that we study as well.
Brian just provided an answer to me on detection limits. And his answer was single ppb for arsenic species and sub ppb for mercury species.
Okay, great. Thank you, Bruce and Brian, for following up on those. So I guess the next one will go to Mary Lou. This comes from Stephen Johnson. Any comment on the bioavailability of arsenic in rice relative to water?
I'm not sure how to compare those two. I mean, they've certainly shown that some of the ways you can decrease the arsenic content of your rice is to, you know, wash it quite extensively before you cook it and to cook it in a lot of water. So that does say that some of that arsenic can be easily removed from the polished rice. And over time, you know, culturally, we've gotten away from cooking our rice that way. We tend to just cook it with the exact amount of water needed, but it really is a much better idea to use more water, both to wash your rice before cooking it and then to cook it with excess water.
Okay. So again, another question for Mary Lou. This comes from Rebecca Newman. What are the downsides, if any, of deploying a new low arsenic uptake rice cultivar in a new location? And then it goes on to ask, or put a different way, why is this not already occurring?
So I think the answer to that has to do with the silicon, because If you have a rice plant that's taking up less silicon, then that rice plant is not going to be as sturdy, so it may fall over and lodge in a heavy wind. And more importantly, they've shown through genetic analysis by mutating some of the transporters that would bring in either arsenite and or silicic acid. If you mutate those transporters, of course, they take up less arsenite, but they also take up less silicate. And then what happens is they're really susceptible to all kinds of rice diseases like rice blast. And so I think that's what's happened in nature. It's a trade-off. They want the silicon. They don't want the, well, we don't want the arsenic. The arsenic doesn't appear to be causing that many problems for the plant. So.
Okay, and here is, I guess, another one for Mary Lou. So is rice arsenic content proportional to concentrations in surrounding media, such as soil, or does it accumulate to saturable concentrations?
That's a little harder to answer. It definitely, they will take up more if there is more present, but I don't know if anybody's shown that that can saturate.
Okay. I guess we'll just keep on going with, seems like there's a lot of interest in arsenic and rice. So the next question comes from Jerry Black, but it's not, I'm not quite clear what he's asking, but he says, what is lower arsenic for the type of rice? So I assume he's probably asking maybe what is the lowest arsenic for the particular type of rice? Or which rice is the lowest amount of arsenic?
Yeah, so obviously it's going to depend where your rice is coming from. But also there's a big genetic component to it. So basmati rice in general has lower arsenic levels than other types of rice.
Okay, and then Jerry has another question. It says, would white rice that's long or short grain, does one or the other maybe accumulate more arsenic?
I don't know that off the top of my head. I know the tropical japonica cultivars tend to have lower arsenic content, and I think the japonica rice tends to be short-grained.
Okay. This one comes from Joseph Ofongwu. Would parboiling rice reduce arsenic levels?
So this is similar to the question about how bioavailable it is. So as I said, it is a good idea to, cook the rice in excess water, and that will help remove some of the arsenic. So parboiling, again, if you were to do it in excess water and then move on to what you want to do with the rice, that would be a good idea.
Okay. So this is kind of an interesting question. This comes from Richard Anander. So since arsenic and radon are both linked to lung cancer, has your research group looked at the incidence of lung cancer in areas with both high levels of arsenic and radon exposure? Maybe Bruce or Celia or Mary Lou?
That would be best answered by Margaret Carrigas. I know Margaret has some conflicts, and she was hoping to get on today. I don't know if she was able to be on the line, but if she is, she would be the best person to give us an answer to that one.
Okay.
So that would unmute would be #6.
Okay. So,
hear me?
Yeah, and if Mary Lou, or excuse me, if Margaret is on the line, again, I should probably do the same thing that Brian Jackson had to do. But so
hello?
Margaret.
Hi, and this is Margaret.
Hi.
Excellent webinar and great question. They are both important in our region, and actually, as part of Bruce's lung biology program, we did have a lung cancer case control study that was led by one of the epidemiologists here looking at arsenic and attempting to look at some issues around radon and doing some exposure assessments. It's it's work that is important and something we're really interested in exploring. But we do have one paper on lung cancer and arsenic exposure and seeing an association between the toenail concentrations of arsenic and lung cancer among those who have lung disease, and trying to incorporate measures of radon is some work that has been done and not yet completed. But it is a question that we're very interested in, so thanks for the question.
Okay, and thanks, Margaret, for being on the line. And since you are on the line, Clem Furlong from our University of Washington Superfund Center, he's asked, so in Washington State, we have arsenic contamination in shellfish grown in proximity of the old Asarco smelter near Tacoma, Washington. Are you aware of any epidemiological studies of populations consuming arsenic in contaminated shellfish?
So that also is a really interesting issue, and I might have to follow up on some specifics on that. There are a number of groups who have tested shellfish and fish for arsenic other than arsenobetaine, which we do assess, and arsenobetaine is an unmetabolized form of arsenic that we don't consider toxic because it isn't metabolized and doesn't change in the body. But there are other forms of arsenic in fish and shellfish that could be potentially toxic or cause adverse health effects. So there is a bit of a body of literature on that, and I can try to steer him in the right direction there.
Okay, and since Margaret, we'll ask one more question, and then we're going to have to turn it over to our other speakers. So I apologize to those that have sent in more questions, but we got a number of additional questions. But this one comes from our next speaker, Dr. Ian Blair, and he asks, how does arsenic increase blood pressure?
Oh, what is the mechanism behind that?
Yeah.
So, there are a number of potential mechanisms. In the studies, and part of the Superfund program is doing a cohort study in Bangladesh, and they've looked at this issue as well. So we've been kind of mirroring projects in New Hampshire from studies that have been done in more highly exposed populations. But there are a number of markers and sort of intermediary markers that impact blood pressure that arsenic impacts. So, there is some mechanistic support for our findings.
But all I can say, again, is thank you very much for some great for a really great presentation. Thanks both to Brian and for Margaret for being able to call in. Thanks to Celia, Mary Lou, and Bruce for being such great colleagues. So anyway, we will get back to other questions if there's time after the next presentation. So next we're going to hear from our University of Pennsylvania Superfund Center. The University of Pennsylvania Center is conducting research to solve problems and find solutions related to chrysotile asbestos fate, exposure, remediation, and adverse health effects such as mesothelioma. The center is driven by community-based concerns from people in Pennsylvania who live close to one of the largest asbestos Superfund sites in the country, the Ambler BioRIT site. We will hear from the University of Pennsylvania SRP Center Director, Dr. Ian Blair, and Deputy Director, Dr. Trevor Penning. So with that, I'll turn it over to Ian.
We have a slight problem in that we don't seem to have the arrows to advance the slides. So is there something we can do, or can you change the slides for us?
Jean or Sarah, could you please help?
Oh, they're back.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Hold on. It looks like, you should now. Sorry, you had re-logged in as a new person, so you should have it now. Do you see it?
Yep, got it. There's the pointer. Okay, so this is Ian Blair here, and I'm sat beside Dr. Penning. And we're going to do a double act in which he's going to give you an introduction. I'm going to talk about the projects. And then we're going to discuss the cause. And we're a relatively new center. We were funded for the first time last year. So our presentation is going to be a little bit different from the Dartmouth presentation. So without further ado, here's Dr. Penning. Thank you for everyone joining us, and also to hear about what we think is an exciting new Superfund research program based here at the University of Pennsylvania. And as you heard, the title of our project is Asbestos Fate, Exposure, Remediation, Adverse Health Effects. So this next slide shows you the problem we have nationally in terms of asbestos Superfund sites. There are a total of 16 Superfund sites represented in 7 different EPA regions across the country. And one that probably many of you are familiar with is the Libby site in Montana in Region 8. However, we have an additional problem in the Bowritch asbestos site.
You need the arrow from the top.
We have an additional problem in the Bowritch site in Ambler, Pennsylvania. This site is probably the second largest Superfund hazardous waste site for asbestos in the country. It covers 25 acres of asbestos waste left behind by a company known as Keesby and Madison that produced asbestos-related products for almost 100 years. And this is clearly a concern to residents who are living in the town of Ambler. So when we started work with the Ambler community, we go all the way back to 2005 and 2006, when our Environmental Health Sciences Core Center at Penn was initially funded by NAHS. And we were contacted then by the Ambler community because of the issue of asbestos waste on their doorstep. And we have been part of their community advisory group since 2006. And over time, we worked with the community to identify a series of questions which ultimately became the basis of our Superfund research program. So one of the questions they had early on, was, can asbestos be remediated in situ? This is a particularly important issue for them because of the asbestos that had not been capped in the area, and the sheer volume of asbestos prevented it from being transported out of Ambler. It's estimated that it would take 18 years with an 18-wheeler truck every 25 minutes to remove this amount of asbestos, to give you an idea of the volume of the asbestos waste. One of the next questions they asked was, is asbestos transported by water? One of the two sites in Bowritch has been capped by the EPA, yet asbestos on that capped site still makes its way into the Wissahickon Creek, which is at the base of that capped site. The next question they had was, why is there a cluster of mesotheliomas among women in Ambler? We actually conducted a study with the ATSDR and the Pennsylvania Department of Health to identify a mesothelioma cluster in Ambler. But surprisingly, the incidence of the disease was higher in women than in Ambler, than in men in Ambler. The next question they wanted to know was, if I've been exposed to asbestos, is there a genetic predisposition to asbestos-induced mesothelioma? And they also were very concerned about, if there has been exposure to asbestos, can mesothelioma onset be prevented? And finally, they were very interested to know if there was some clinical test available that could determine whether or not one had been exposed to asbestos and whether one was predisposed to developing mesothelioma. And so they were very interested in the possibility of a blood test. These questions all came from the community and then led to the development of the projects for the Superfund program that we have here at Penn. So this shows in the next slide how the 6 projects that we have and the cause are actually all aimed at answering the questions that the community has just posed. And you will see on the left-hand side how these projects really are responsive to the Superfund research program because they cover remediation, fate and transport,
issues of environmental justice, epidemiology, health effects, and mechanistic toxicology. So project one looks at whether or not mycorrhizal fungi in serpentine plants can actually remediate asbestos by changing its mineral form. Project two actually investigates asbestos mobility and transport through soil and also in water. Project three actually looks at exposure pathways that retrospectively that might have increased the incidence of mesothelioma in women rather than in men in Ambler. Project four, we have rodent models of mesothelioma, which are based on tumor suppressor knockout animals, which when given asbestos, develop mesothelioma. And this gives us a wonderful model for looking at the onset and pathogenesis of the disease. And it also gives us an animal model in which we can determine whether the remediated asbestos in Project 1 is more or less toxic. We can also go to Project 5, which is where we look at the chemo prevention of asbestos-induced disease. This again uses the animal models, and here we're using antioxidants found in flaxseed to see if we can actually prevent the onset of mesothelioma in the tumor suppressor knockout animals. And finally, Project 6 is a biomarker project to look at the development of biomarkers for asbestos exposure, and this can actually look at biomarkers that we might be able to detect in the serum of the rodent models and also in a human cohort study. I would say that each of these projects were made possible by the Environmental Health Sciences Core Center here at Penn because five of these six projects received pilot project funding from the Environmental Health Sciences Core Center to acquire the necessary preliminary data for us to allow to proceed with this project. We also have the very traditional cores associated with the Superfund Center here at Penn. We have a community engagement core, a research translation core, a biostats core, and an interdisciplinary training core, which you'll hear about, which we think is somewhat unique. So this is the Penn SRP Center website that we've developed. And in the in the far left corner of this slide, you will see one of the asbestos waste sites in Ambler. These white hills that you see are not sand, that's asbestos waste. This site is one of the sites that has been capped by the EPA, but notice before it was capped, the proximity to the children's playground. In the middle of this slide, you will also see the health advisory that we developed with the Pennsylvania Department of Health and the ATSDR looking at mesothelioma incidence in Ambler, and you will see that the expected increase, the expected number of mesothelioma cases is much, much higher than the observed case is much, much higher than the expected cases. And this was related to doing epidemiological work in Ambler versus the adjacent zip codes. And as I've already indicated, the mesothelioma incidence was higher in women than in men. And at the bottom here, you will see our website for our Superfund Center. And I think this completes the overview, and I will let Dr. Blair talk about the individual projects.
Okay, so project one, as Dr. Penning mentioned, is a remediation project. The hypothesis is that it will be possible to discover better ways to remediate asbestos sites in situ. And as he mentioned, you know, the possibility of removing the asbestos from Ambler really is not going to happen because of the hazard of having all those trucks and also the enormous cost. I think it was estimated it would cost over $100 million to actually remove the asbestos, aside from the fact that it would take 10 years to do it. And so this project involves the use of hyperaccumulating plants that will remove toxic metals from the asbestos. And by using naturally occurring serpentine plants and arbuscular mycorrhizal fungi to help concentrate the heavy metals from the asbestos. And so here's another view of the site, and you can see where the arrows are showing, or where my green arrow is. These are some of the asbestos-containing materials that are strewn across the site. And then on the right hand here, we can see, you know, the capping process. And before the pile was completely capped, Jane and some of her students are seen here collecting soil to test some of the plants and fungi to see if the asbestos can be remediated. And here's one of the locations that's also shown by a white arrow where I've placed my green arrow. So they've done quite a bit of field work in accumulating relevant samples, and one of the very important aspects of this is being able to collaborate with the EPA to get access to the site, and I must say they've been extraordinarily helpful in allowing us to get to the site and to obtain relevant soil samples. So as you may imagine, this research is ongoing, and so what I've shown here is sort of an overview of how we anticipate this moving, although we do have some primary data showing how effective it is. But basically, the mycorrhizal fungi are going to give exudates, which will mobilize particularly the iron that's present in asbestos, which is really thought to be responsible for the oxidative stress that underlies the toxicity of asbestos. And so the concept here is that by removing the iron from the asbestos, it changes the molecular form from a toxic to a non-toxic form. And then having done that, we'll be able to test whether the remediated asbestos possesses a toxicity in the animal models that we've developed. So moving on then to project two, this addresses one of the really particular concerns of the community. Every time I meet with them, they ask me about this because often the area will flood and the asbestos will be transported into the basements of the people surrounding the Bowrid site. So this is a project from the from investigators from the Department of Earth and Environmental Sciences in our School of Arts and Sciences, Dr. Jerome Mack and Dr. Willenbring. Excuse me. And their hypothesis is that the mobility of asbestos particles in groundwater has been underestimated, and that there are certain aspects of the material that will allow it to be transported significantly different from other fine particles. And I think what's driving this project is the fact that there's virtually no information known about the transport of asbestos within soil. And one of the problems is in actually trying to visualize it. And what's very striking is the progress that's been made in trying to address this issue. So what Dr. Jerome Mack and Willenbring have been able to do is to tag the asbestos particles with a fluorescent protein. And so here's a picture of the fluorescence that emanates from the different sized particles after being tagged with that particle. And so what's evident on the right-hand portion of the slide is that as you put the asbestos into water, there's a tremendous amount of clumping and transport of the asbestos particles. And what they've been able to do is quantify this transport. So here we see in the top left-hand corner here how the particles can be tracked, how their trajectories can be monitored, and then how different sizes of particles are moving through the water at different rates. And so what they're doing now is to develop an algorithm for this clumping and movement through the water, which will provide the first real information on how asbestos can be transported. So the Project 3, which is has two co-PIs of Dr. Barg and Dr. Emwood from the School of Medicine here at Penn, and this really represents a transition from that basic science, those basic science projects, to the biomedical science aspects of our program. And their hypothesis is that the incidence of mesothelioma is related both to occupational and non-occupational exposures, such as, for example, women washing their husband's clothes that were contaminated by asbestos, or the proximity of the site. For example, are they downwind of the asbestos in the Bowritz site? And in order to address these issues, they've developed an incredibly exciting study in which they've been able to identify every single person who lived in Ambler, and from their street addresses, they'll know the proximity to the site. And then, as this was from 1930, all of those people are now dead, and so they have their death certificates, and they're going to determine what disease they died from and how is that related to where they lived in Ambler. And as far as I'm aware, this will be the first study where an entire town has been interrogated for the causes of death. So along with that, they're also conducting interviews with people who are either affected or have a relative affected by mesothelioma to sort of generate hypotheses as to what might be going on in terms of the asbestos exposure. So it's sort of not like the way we develop hypotheses as sort of basic scientists, but it's just a very interesting alternative way of developing hypotheses as to how mesothelioma occurred. Then in Project 4, which is really a major project coming out of Fox Chase in collaboration with our group from a famous mesothelioma scientist, Dr. Tester, and he's working with Dr. Simmons here in the Perelman School of Medicine and looking both at mutations in key tumor suppressor genes, but also in epigenetic effects on changes that occur in mesothelioma. And so the underlying hypothesis for this work is that you can develop animal models of susceptibility to malignant mesothelioma. And so here's a time-life curve of, a time-life curve of mice, normal mice treated with asbestos. And you can see after about 42 weeks, there's a significant death rate from malignant mesothelioma. However, knocking out various tumor suppressor genes increases the risk, and so when two of them are disrupted, you get a much faster progression towards mesothelioma. Dr. Tester had found a cluster of mesotheliomas amongst mutations in BRCA-related protein, or BAP1, and so he's developed a mouse model of that, in which he knocks out one of the alleles of BAP1 and sees that there's an increasing susceptibility to mesothelioma in that particular mouse model. So we feel this is actually a really important project because of three things. First, it allows us to test the remediated asbestos and see if it has the same effects. And second, the next two projects I'll get to, the first of these is the chemo prevention. Will the chemo prevention agents prevent this progression? And then the third question is, will we see changes in biomarkers in these models when compared to the wild-type mice? So moving on to Project 5 then, which is a Penn-based project from Dr. Melpo Christofidou-Solomadou and another famous mesothelioma doctor, Dr. Albelda. where they're very interested in flaxseed derivatives, this unpronounceable major constituent, which I'll call STG, which we think interferes with the inflammasome and reactive oxygen species generation, and so will prevent the progression to mesothelioma. And so basically what they're very interested in doing is showing that this molecule and its precursor, lignans, will prevent oxidative stress, and which is thought to be one of the main underlying mechanisms involved in the progression of asbestos-related diseases to mesothelioma. And so I'll show you some data from the SV40 mouse model, which is also actually susceptible to mesothelioma. But they're also doing work in one of those other models I showed you, and looking at various aspects of oxidative stress. And in these particular studies, they're not using the very expensive STG molecule, but they're using a preparation known as flaxseed lignan complex, or FLC, in these particular mouse models. And so looking at various cytokines and inflammation, and I wouldn't be showing you this if it wasn't true, there's a significant effect on nitrite, IL-1 beta, and TNF-alpha levels, as shown here. There's a significant reduction in the presence of the flaxseed lignan of the nitrite, the IL-1 beta, and the TNF-alpha. And so it's going to be very interesting to see if that extends to the BAT1 model, and that's something that's ongoing at the moment. And hopefully a publication on this will appear in the near future. So the final project, the one I'm going to talk about before handing over the course to Dr. Penning, is a collaboration between myself in the Department of Systems Pharmacology and Translational Therapeutic and Dr. Vachani, who's a pulmonologist in the Department of Medicine. And we came up with the notion that serum metabolomics, particularly lipidomics, using ultra-high resolution mass spectrometry, would reveal novel biomarkers that might be able to be used as an indicator of early detection of mesothelioma. But as we've moved along, we think more importantly, as a target for novel mesothelioma drugs that are appearing on the market. And as every drug now needs a biomarker before it can move on to phase 3, we think this is going to be a really important issue in the future. So here's a schematic of what we're about. So we've so far done quite a bit of stuff in asbestos-exposed controls and mesothelioma patients. So we just do a basic lipid extraction using a Falch method and take the organic phase, which is rich in lipids. We're using nanoacuity UPLC to perform the separations, and currently working on LTQ Orbitrap around 100,000 resolution. I must say parenthetically, we just received funding for another mass spectrometer with higher resolution, and so we expect this to be even more revealing in the future. But the basic idea is the same, to interrogate differences between the asbestos exposed and the mesothelioma, and of course, well, it's a lot easier to look at controls to look for differences. And we found actually that SIV is a much better program for this than XCMS, which tends to have a lot of false positives. But then most importantly, we can do tandem mass spectrometry on our HIT with collision-induced dissociation, either using high-energy or low-energy collisions. And from the product ion spectrum of the metabolites, we can assign a preliminary structure and then confirm the structure using authentic molecules. And so this has moved quite quickly now. So we've identified three lipids, molecular weights between 300 and 400, with relatively high sensitivity and specificity, around 80% for lipid 1, 95% for lipid 2, and again 90% for lipid 3. So multiplexing them together gives a relatively high sensitivity and specificity, certainly much better than any of the existing protein biomarkers that have been developed to date, such as the soluble mesothelin-related peptides, fibrin 3, or high mobility group box 1, which have all of them have some defects either in sensitivity or specificity. And probably what we will eventually do is combine our panel of lipids with the panel of proteins so that we can approach 100% sensitivity and specificity. And at the moment, we're trying to interest an investor in starting a company to develop these biomarkers, and we're moving forward to patent the biomarkers that we've discovered. So with that, I'm going to hand over to Dr. Penning, who's going to describe some of the calls, the ones that are highlighted in blue.
Thank you, Ian. So I'm going to be talking about three calls: the community engagement call, the research translation call, and our interdisciplinary training call. So our community engagement call is led by Ted Emmett and Fran Barg. And if you recall, these were also the PIs on Project Free, which was the social determinants of asbestos exposure. Ted Emmett has been working with the community advisory group in AMBLA since 2005 and has a long and rich history of working with them. And as you can see, one of the hypotheses of the community engagement core is to translate the concerns of the community into research projects. And you've already seen how we've done that. And what's another component of this is to actually meet with the CAG every month, which is what we've been doing, to actually update them on the research that they have actually helped us define in the very first place. So when we were initially funded, we were very excited and managed to get the word out through the Philadelphia Inquirer and made the front page about how the AMBLA community is living in the asbestos shadow, and also how the work might be transferable to the other EPA's Superfund sites that have asbestos hazardous waste. This is Bob Adams, who is a member of the CAG, and in the Philadelphia Inquirer article, he is quoted as saying that if there was a blood test for asbestos exposure and mesothelioma onset, he would be the first to take it. And he's been a member of the CAG since its inception. One of the important things that the community engagement core has been doing is it has a separate grant, a REACH award from the NIH Director's Office, in which it's actually putting together an exhibit at the Chemical Heritage Museum, which is here based in Philadelphia, to put the story together of how the asbestos factory town AMBLA thrived with the asbestos industry, and now how it's paying the consequences in terms of asbestos-related disease. And one of the reasons for this museum exhibit is not only to tell the story, but also to make sure that we don't make the same mistakes again, whether it be for asbestos waste or other hazardous waste, where companies leave behind their hazardous material and the community, in this case the environmental justice community, is then faced with the cleanup problem and the ill effects of the asbestos exposure. Also, the Community Outreach and Engagement Corps is also putting together a series of plays that will be running at the AMBLA Playhouse. And these plays give residents the opportunity to act out their stories in real time. The CAG has also developed a video of AMBLA to show where the site is, how it's affecting residents currently, and also interviews with residents who currently do have asbestos-related disease. It's a very powerful video, and it's available on our website. So we also have a research translation corps, and this is led by two experts, which have different two experts with different expertise. Richard Pepino actually had 25 years of experience working with the EPA Region 3. He's now retired, but is now a part of our Superfund research program. And for the research translation corps, he can really deal with the issues of how we can translate our findings to the EPA and other federal agencies to improve or change how we do a risk assessment in terms of asbestos exposure. Robert Schenkel, on the other hand, is one of the associate directors of the Penn Innovation Center, which is the center here at Penn that actually translates research findings into patents and also licensure and also the commercial enterprise itself. And so the hypothesis of the Research Translation Corps is that knowledge and discoveries at the center can be translated into actionable items that will help remediate asbestos waste, that's projects 1 and 2, and reduce its adverse health effects, projects 3 and 6, by forging productive partnerships with public and private sectors. The Research Translation Corps has two subcommittees. It had Technology and Development and Transfer, a committee, which is made up of individuals both here at Penn and also in federal agencies to actually start thinking about how we can actually move inventions and products from the Superfund research program into technologies that can ultimately be field deployed or actually be licensed. So, for example, if we are successful in our remediation strategy, then how can that be field deployed? If we're successful in developing a blood test of mesothelioma, how can that actually be protected and actually put forward into ultimately a new diagnostic or prognostic assay? For the research translation and application, this really refers to how we are going to take information and relate this to federal agencies so that we can actually do better risk assessment and also be concerned about how we can do effective remediation. So this is how these different entities interact. We have the translational and development technology group over here, and you can see the input is from the PIs of the projects and also the trainees, how this will lead to inventions and patents, and also develop new targeted opportunities. This information goes to the RTA group, and they can assess whether the research is practical, reasonable, or implementable. And of course, the stakeholders are involved in terms of the regulatory agencies and also determine whether we're dealing with products in terms of patents and marketing or process to change management practices and remediation and risk assessment. So the last core I would like to tell you about is our interdisciplinary training core, which is led by myself, who am based in the School of Medicine, and Jane Willenbring, who's based in the School of Arts and Sciences, in the Department of Earth and Environmental Sciences. So this is led by a biomedical scientist and an environmental scientist. And the mission of the Interdisciplinary Superfund Research Training Program is to provide serious cross-training in environmental science and environmental health science to ensure that all trainees master the necessary skills and have sufficient knowledge base to understand the hazards of Superfund waste sites and then use this knowledge to help remediate these sites and their ensuing health effects. And so it's a real marriage of the two disciplines of environmental science and environmental health science. So we have put together a training program which actually trainees supported by the SRP Center here at Penn can take. So we have trainees of two types. We have PhD students who are enrolled in our certificate program in environmental health sciences, and we have PhD students who are enrolled or have come from the Masters in Environmental Studies or the Biology graduate group. And in the fall of the first year, we have a new course, Introduction to Superfund Sites and Health Effects of Hazardous Waste. This course deals with the Superfund legislation. It deals with risk assessment in terms of hazard identification, hazard characterization, risk communication and risk management. It deals with major ways of remediation. It deals with the issues of the ecosystem on hazardous waste, and also then translates into major hazardous waste chemicals, their classes, and their adverse health effects. In the spring, students from the biomedical or environmental health sciences program will do a research methods course, which will enable them to be trained to do a summer rotation, but not a laboratory rotation, but instead field work in the AMBLA community. By contrast, PhD students in environmental studies or biology will do molecular toxicology, which is our flagship toxicology course, and they will do a lab-based rotation. All students in the summer will be doing an epidemiology and biostats course. In the fall of the second year, students in the biomedicine or the environmental science, environmental health sciences will do the environmental sciences elective and then graduate with a PhD from their graduate group. And similarly, students in environmental sciences will do in the second year our occupational environmental health course and then get a PhD from the SAS graduate group. And I should say that Penn is graduate groups that give PhD degrees, not departments. And graduate groups are made up of faculty that share common interests. So we have many different graduate groups in BGS and many different graduate groups in SAS. This course and curriculum were approved by Biomedical Graduate Studies and the School of Arts and Sciences in the fall of 2014. And so this fall will be the first year that we'll be offering this complete training program to our trainees. As part of the interdisciplinary training core, as you can see, we have an integrated curriculum and the new course on Superfund hazardous waste. We actually also have put together optional training experiences for our trainees, and these include externships with the US EPA, both here in Region 3 in Philadelphia and in Washington, D.C. We have a Penn Center for Innovation and Scholars program, which actually can train trainees in what it takes to take a discovery or disclosure invention all the way through the intellectual property process, and also a community engagement experience whereby we have the capacity to train trainees in risk communication. Our trainees also can take part in our joint SEAT SRP seminar series and annual symposium. And lastly, I want to highlight a person by the name of Atu Agarwal, who was actually given a supplement as a trainee on our P42 program. Atu is an MD, MPH student, so that's quite remarkable that somebody from a medical school background, an MPH program, should immediately become interested in our Superfund research program. And he's been working on Project 3 on the social determinants of asbestos exposure. And so we were delighted that he was able to get that supplement. So these are the acknowledgments the Penn SRP Center would like to give to all of our different project leaders, Projects 1 through Project 6, and also to our individuals involving the individual cause. I'm sure Ian would like to say a few words to close.
I just would like to say thanks for everyone's attention, and We'd be delighted to answer questions. I hope they're not as complicated as the ones that Bruce had to answer, however. So we're done. We lost them.
Ian, are you still there?
Yeah, we're still here.
Okay, I'm sorry. For a second there, I thought maybe I had lost you. So.
Yeah, we thought we lost you too.
Okay, yeah, that was weird. It was just kind of like paused for a second. So, okay, I think we're ready to start with questions then. Okay, so the first one that, and first of all, thank you very much, both Ian and Trevor, for that great presentation. You guys have done so much work. I just want everybody to know that they have come in with a number of updates. They send us regular updates on all the activities. So this is a very, very active group. So the first one comes in, it's more of a comment from Anne Strickland. And this is, she says, the speakers may wish to clarify that the 16 asbestos sites on their map slide include only the NPL sites. There are many more asbestos sites that EPA is involved with. Addressing, example, the Libby sister sites and the wide variety of industrial sites that have significant asbestos contamination in addition to other contaminants.
Well, thank you for that comment. We shall be more careful in future.
Okay. So Celia Chen, who just spoke, she asked, does asbestos end up in surface water, and if so, does it deposit to the sediments or does it remain in the water column? Is there risk to aquatic organisms?
That's a very good question. The whole issue, the whole issue of toxicity has been devoted to inhalation toxicology. There's very little known about ingestion through the water supply. And one of the concerns is when it gets into the water supply, that as the water levels decrease, there are asbestos particles left on the banks, which could then be blown into the air. So that's the concern at the moment. But we're also investigating whether there could be a component of toxicity due to contamination of water.
Okay. So the next question comes in from John Hardy. Is there a difference in dose response between friable and non-friable asbestos-containing materials?
So I think our focus is on the chrysotile asbestos right now, which is the major form of asbestos in Ambler. And as you can see, the SRP at Penn was developed around the concerns of the citizen Ambler, and surprisingly, historically, there is has been debate over whether chrysotile asbestos can actually cause mesothelioma. Well, I think the epidemiology that we've done in Ambler suggests otherwise, and also chrysotile does contain various concentrations of iron, and so therefore, the question is not a simple one in terms of dose response in just terms of the asbestos. It's also an issue of the dose response to the amount of iron that might be present in the asbestos.
Okay.
So kind of as a follow-up question, this comes from Terry Trent. And so as Ian you had just and Trevor, you just mentioned about the focus on chrysotile, I think he's asking about, is there any chrysotilite present at the site?
It's sort of controversial. I think there is some evidence of that, right?
Yes.
So it could be some issue of mixtures here, and so that's why one of the reasons that we obtained samples so as we can determine the relative amounts of chrysotile and chrysotilite.
Okay. So the next question comes in from Angela Gutierrez, and she asks, we would like to know what lipid 1, 2, and 3 are. They seem very interesting and may be potential biomarkers for other toxicant exposure.
Well, we hope not. So we think they're specific for mesothelioma, and we're not revealing the structures right now. We have to be very careful or we will violate our patent protection.
Okay. So this one, another one that comes in from Terry Trent. He says, Masovo Grease Amphibole Grease, the country, amphibole fiber is almost free of iron and shows one of the highest levels of mesothelioma from a medium carcinogenic potential fiber. Why are we thinking removing iron will not increase toxic potential of fibers?
So I think the issue here is we're not trying to say that iron is the only culprit in terms of causing a health effects related to asbestos. But clearly, iron is an important contaminant. What we have found is in our studies when we've removed the iron from the asbestos we're working with is that the mineral form itself starts to change, suggesting that particle aspect ratio and size also is affected. And so now we get into the issue of particle toxicology. And so it's not just the chemical composition, but it's also aspect size and shape that are important as well.
Okay, so kind of as a, I guess as a follow-up question from Justin Kowalowski, when you remove iron from asbestos-like structure, is the structure still present?
I think we just addressed that.
So we actually have electron micrograph capability, and so that's part of the studies that are ongoing to actually look at the discrete structures that have changed.
One of the other ways we're interested in moving is in doing a bronchoalveolar lavage and to actually see what types of asbestos could be present in the lungs of people living in Ambler. So that's something that we're developing that when Danielle is here for our site visit, we can talk more about.
Okay. Julie Roble, she's has just really a comment, but I think a very useful comment. She says, Sumas Mountain asbestos site is not a Superfund site, but a location with naturally occurring asbestos. Also, USGS is about to release a report on transport of asbestos in water.
Oh, good. We'd be interested
to see
that.
Yeah.
Okay. And then Julie also followed up. She says, yes, there is a difference in the release of fibers from friable versus non-friable materials. So thank you, Julie, for those comments. Okay. She has one more. She says, finally, while iron may be one determinant of toxicity, there are other factors such as fiber dimension, mineral properties may contribute to toxicity.
I think that our point is we can see whether what we've done removes the toxicity. So I think we're addressing these issues. We agree. It's very complicated, and we're only looking at one aspect of it. But at least we have a method to test to see if we've reduced the toxicity.
Okay, but she does have a follow-up, and she said that she's not quite understanding how plants could phytoremediate the quantity of fibers that we find at most sites.
So I think all of these things, our studies right now are all greenhouse-based, whereby we've been identifying the most efficient fungal infections that we can use to actually remediate asbestos. The concept is that once we have got that working in the greenhouse environment, we would like to field deploy. We're certainly looking at ways in which we can actually grow plants on the serpentine soil, so it will go through the capped asbestos and hopefully they will be efficient secretors of agents that they make. It's generally oxalic acid and oxalic acid derivatives that actually remove the iron from the asbestos. And so that's the concept.
And some of these grasses have very long root systems, so that's our hope, that they can get down to relatively deep levels to do the remediation. But actually, I'm not a world expert on this, so I better be careful what I say.
I mean, we can certainly put her into contact with Brenda Casper, who is, you know, one of our experts in the remediation field, to help answer this question.
Okay. So since we still have just a few more minutes left, I just want to be sure that we make sure that we end on time. I did want to go ahead and open the question and answer session, and I just wanted to be sure we had time for anybody that was on the phone. So if you'd like to ask a question, please take your phone off of mute by pressing #6, state your name and organization, and ask your question. And you can remute your phone by pressing *6. So is there anybody on the line that would like to ask a verbal question? Okay, sounds like everybody's pretty much sending in, because we have several more questions. And again, I apologize if we do not get to your question, but I will do my best. So I guess we'll just continue with the UPenn Center. So the next one, this comes from Ann Strickland. She asks, how does the UPenn Center work, especially the Community Engagement Corps, related to the planning effort for the BioRitz site, which contemplates a park field with ball fields, playgrounds, a boys and girls club, running trails, et cetera?
So I'm not sure if I fully understand the question, but clearly we are in constant communication with the residents in Ambler through the CAG, and the issues that they have been most concerned about historically have been the building of a high-rise apartment complex on the site when the site hasn't been fully remediated, and also the fact that that portion of the site is actually very close to McDonald's. They're the concerns that we've heard about. The ones that she's raising, I've not heard about, but Ted Emmett may well have done, and Ted could not join today because he's not well. But certainly we can put those questions to Ted.
Okay, and I think this is a follow-up again from Ann Strickland.
If I could just say one thing, I mean, there is certainly a lot of interest in remediating the brownfield, and Richard Pepino has been very involved in working with the EPA on that. So that, I'm sure, is something that we can follow up on.
Okay, because she had one more added comment. Again, this is from Ann Strickland. She mentions that that there is a planning document that's prepared by WITPAIN, and so she gives a link. So we will be sure that you receive that link as well.
So we actually did meet very recently with the county commissioner to discuss our Superfund research program and the projects with her, and surprisingly, she didn't mention this WITPAIN document, so it'd be great to see it.
Okay. Let me see. Okay. So here's one from Leonid Kopliev. He asks, how would mesothelioma update for a town to deal with the lack of ICD code for mesothelioma before 1999?
Not sure I understand the question.
So it sounds to me like ICD codes might not be available for those with mesothelioma before 1999. So how could...
Oh, I see, in the death certificates.
Yeah, I think that's what he's talking about, yeah.
I'm sorry, that's, again, outside my area of expertise. I assume that that's something that's been addressed.
Okay, and maybe it's something that... one of your other project investigators could probably try to...
Yeah, so if we could get that question, I'll pass it on to Fran Barg, who's in charge of that study.
Uh-oh, My Adobe Connect add-in has stopped working. Okay. Okay. I apologize, but I do not have access. I don't know what happened. My Adobe. But I think with 4 minutes to go, I think we'll just go ahead and perhaps end the seminar or end the webinar, because I still have a few things I have left to as our University of Pennsylvania Superfund Center. So I just want to make sure that everyone is aware of the related URLs pod, which contains the seminar resources and seminar feedback links. On the seminar resources page, we have assembled resources directly applicable to today's topic. This will stay with the seminar indefinitely, so you can access it after the presentation. We typically place these seminars in an archive with a soundtrack, so in the near future, you'll be able to access the slides and hear the presentation as it was given today. Also, in the related URLs pod, you will find an online seminar feedback form. So we ask you to consider filling out the online feedback form. We do look at your comments as we continue to try to improve the content and delivery mechanisms. Links to the seminar resources and the seminar feedback form can also be found on the last slide of the presentation. And so I would like to remind participants of the various ways to stay connected to ensure you don't miss any of the webinars. And for more information on EPA's CLUIN webinars, please refer to the cluin.org website. There's also the EPA Cleanup Tech Facebook page. Follow EPA Cleanup Tech on Twitter. Join the Cleanup Information Network CLUIN LinkedIn group. Visit the SRP Progress in Research and Risky Learning webpages, and follow us on SRP_NIEHS on Twitter. I just want to mention that if you have any additional questions, you can contact the presenters also via email. Their email addresses are on the seminar homepage on CLUIN, which is linked to from the webinar webpage. If you submitted an online question and we did not get to it, my apologies, but it will be forwarded on to the presenters. Once again, I'd like to thank our presenters, Dr. Bruce Stanton, Dr. Celia Chen, Dr. Mary Lou Gruneau, Dr. Ian Blair, and Dr. Trevor Penning, and again, as well as Brian Jackson and Margaret Carrigus, for their time preparing and for sharing their presentations with us today. Since my Adobe Connect has now failed, I just want to let everybody know that we will have another research in progress webinar coming up, and more information will be sent, and that, I believe, is our Northeastern and our University of Kentucky Superfund Centers will be talking about their work. So please stay tuned for that. So again, if you have any questions, follow-up questions, our presenters would be happy, I'm sure, to answer that your questions. So with that, thank you to our webinar audience for your participation, and I think that concludes today's presentation.